Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for regular host David Inge. Glad you could listen. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Travis Stancil, and at the controls, Jason Croft. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the politics of healthcare reform. In June of this year, the U.S. House and Senate passed the biggest expansion and overhaul of Medicare since the federal government program was created in 1965. The legislation would cost $400 billion over the next 10 years and would create a major new prescription drug benefit for the 40 million Americans covered by Medicare. But if you are one of the many people struggling to pay rising drug costs, don't pop the champagne cork just yet. The House and the Senate passed different versions, some would say visions, of the Medicare overhaul, and right now they're in conference, bogged down by, surprise, partisan disagreement. What happens next? What effect does the coming election have on this process? And what role does the media play in the making of health policy under these very political circumstances? Our guest for this hour is a reporter who has covered national politics, including the healthcare reform battles in Congress, for the past 18 years. Robin Toner is a senior writer in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. She was the national political correspondent from 1989 through the election of 1992, becoming the first woman to hold that position at the New York Times. After the 1992 election, she focused on the Clinton administration's national health care reform effort and then the Republican Congress's contract with America. She also served as chief of correspondence on the national desk and as senior congressional correspondent and has written widely for the New York Times other sections, including the Times Book Review and the New York Times Magazine. Since 1999, Robin Toner has been reporting on the intersection of politics and policy on domestic issues, including Medicare and health care in general. If you are a reader of the New York Times, you've read a lot of her work, and we're glad to have her with us this morning. As we talk with Robin Toner, you are welcome to join the conversation. All you have to do is call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, around the Midwest here, or if you're listening online, anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. And Robin Toner is here in town. She spoke yesterday at 4 o'clock at an event sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on Healthcare and Social Welfare. And we're glad to have her with us here in the studio.
I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. Maybe we could begin by talking about where things stand with the Medicare legislation. It is a big story, but I wonder if people haven't really, you know, since the debacle in 1994, maybe haven't felt, brave enough to follow.
It's a big story, and it's a complicated story. And the challenge of both writing about and following a story like this is that it goes on and on and on sometimes. A lot of people who read the New York Times and read other newspapers at the end of June, I think it was, when they passed the first versions of the bill in the House and the Senate, probably thought that within a very short period of time, it would be signed into law. Yeah. and we'd have a new Medicare bill. There's a lot of twists and turns before that happens, and they're in conference right now. As you mentioned at the start, the House and the Senate passed really different versions of the bill. I think that the White House was just really eager to get something going, and they really pushed them to get something out so they could go to conference, which is basically representatives from each chamber getting together and trying to negotiate a bill, a final bill. It's very much up in the air right now. They've got real big divisions.
Now, this was an issue that President Bush campaigned on. It was mm-hmm. one of his big things that mm-hmm. he wanted to make happen in Congress, is Medicare reform and a prescription drug benefit.
Yeah, I think they very much want to do this bill, but particularly before the election really kicks in. The conventional wisdom in Washington is it's hard to do something big in an election year, meaning next year, because you just get such partisanship and you get so many people so dug in. I think they would really like to do it, and I think that's why they really pushed it. President Bush did campaign on this. He promised to do it. The Republicans control the House and the Senate and the White House, and I think that there's some anxiety in the Republican Party that if they don't produce a bill, voters are going to have some questions next year.
So what are the differences between the House and Senate versions?
A lot of the differences really come down to how much you want to open Medicare up to private health plans. The House bill, because of the nature of the House, because it's so much more conservative and because whatever party controls a majority in the House has much more control over how legislation moves, the bill there was pretty much written by Republicans. And it reflects a vision of Medicare in which basically you have a lot more private health plans involved and traditional fee-for-service Medicare. You have the right to stay with it, but the program will be competing with these private health plans directly eventually. The Senate bill was much more of an attempt to strike a compromise with Democrats. It was largely drafted by moderate Republicans, and it reflects a continued strong role for government in both providing the drug benefit. If private plans don't come in a region, the government will provide the drug benefit. And also, it's much more gentle, I think most people would say, in the way it moves towards competition in the program.
Mm-hmm. So the conservatives in the House in particular have problems with the Senate version mm-hmm. of the bill. Can you talk about some of the – this has gotten bogged down in ideology, essentially.
It really has, I think. I mean, I think there are really fundamentally different worldviews here. We talked a little bit at the university speech yesterday about this. When you look at these programs, Social Security and Medicare, they were created in the case of Medicare and the Great Society, in the case of Social Security, in the New Deal, and they really are kind of basic government social insurance programs. Very traditional and, haven't changed kind of fundamentally in a long time. The Republican vision of Medicare and Social Security would have more private market forces involved. They say they would like to offer the elderly more choices, more flexibility. Democrats, on the other hand, look at this and see it as an attempt to privatize these programs and expose the elderly to a lot more risk, whether it's the risk of not being able to afford, a plan as good as what you have right now, or whether it's the risk of putting part of your savings into the stock market and not doing so well. It is a fundamentally different vision, and it's going to be hard to strike a compromise in this conference committee.
Are some of the House Republicans essentially saying we don't believe that Medicare is something that the government has a role. I mean, that this is the type of program that we are trying to get the U.S. government out of.
They wouldn't go that far, mm-hmm. no. I mean, what they would say, though, is that we need to have more flexibility, more choice. Mm-hmm. Most Republicans are in the House are very careful to say, if you want to stay with traditional Medicare, you can stay with traditional Medicare. But if you don't, if you would like to stay with them, if you would like to go to a managed care plan or any number of private health plans, then you ought to have that right, too. And we ought to structure the marketplace so that you have full freedom and full choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the other splits seems to be between rural and urban representatives. The plan would play out in very different ways, or the fear is that it would play out in different ways.
Yeah. People from rural areas are very skeptical that these private health plans will actually come in and compete for their business. I mean, the experience of a lot of these members of the House and the Senate from rural areas is that, Medicare has had Medicare HMOs, available in recent years. But they've largely been in suburban and urban areas. And I think the fear of a lot of legislators in both parties from rural areas is that that their constituents will be left out in this, that you'll move to a system that just fundamentally doesn't work in the rural areas, and so they're digging in on that, okay. Understandably. And it's worth remembering that rural legislators from rural areas have a lot of power still in the House and the Senate, a lot, particularly in the Finance Committee.
A lot of the details of the plan are in the prescription drug coverage, and some of the stories that I've read seem to reflect a lot of confusion exactly how this would play out, that it's so complicated, mm-hmm. that it's really hard to understand.
Yeah.
Is there a way to explain it to make it understandable?
It's pretty complicated, I have to say, and that's another big concern, I think. As they move towards kind of the conference committee and trying to figure out what should be in the final plan, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of members in the Senate and the House are worried that this will get out, that if if they are successful, this will get out to older Americans and you know, any of us, a lot of us, let's say, who have to make decisions on health insurance mm-hmm. get lost, okay? It's, you know, open enrollment period is often a difficult experience for a lot of working Americans.
Yes.
And I think a lot of legislators are worried that it will be even more so for a lot of senior citizens who are struggling with choices and options and, you know, benefit packages and gaps in coverage and premiums. It'd be a whole new confusing world for them.
Well, there's 40 million Americans involved in Medicare. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the questions is, would offering a prescription drug benefit, whether it be through the government standard plan or through a private plan, would that in some sense create a situation where people who are already have coverage for prescription drug benefits through their retirement plan, would then those companies offering those benefits say, okay, well, Medicare is covering
That's
this,
right.
so more people are going to be on Medicare essentially through, at least as far as prescription drug
yeah.
coverage.
I mean, that is a fear, and that is a problem when you're making health policy and when you're offering new benefits. You don't want to crowd out, as the expression people use, existing private plans that are mm-hmm. often quite good, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so you don't want people to lose coverage as a result of you offering coverage. And so they are trying to figure out how to put certain incentives in so that these retiree plans don't drop out.
Mm-hmm. And that reading the coverage, that seemed like, you know, that wasn't thought of initially.
The problem is when you're making legislation,
yeah.
you know, it's like, they thought of it, but in the push to get something through, you know, so that they could get to this next level. I mean, there's a lot of times when you're passing legislation in the first go round, there's a lot of thought like, we'll deal with that in conference. We'll deal with that in conference. We'll deal with that in conference, which is why the conference gets so hard, because they didn't want the train to go off track. You know, they didn't want to spend a lot of time focusing on one little thing that would then kind of derail the whole process, because they really are under the gun. The president was putting a lot of pressure on them.
Okay. We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. And we would welcome others. Let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Robin Toner. She covers national politics from the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. She's in town here to speak here on the campus of the University of Illinois. And we've got her here in the studio talking about politics and health care reform and perhaps the election as well. If you'd like to join us, the number 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll go first to a listener in Belgium on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes. Now, I live on the edge of rural America, a very small town, village, actually. And we have problems with health care here a lot. That's why you hear a lot of it from the rural areas, because doctors don't want to come here. But the question I have is, 10 years ago, the Clintons tried to go through this, and the very people who are in office now, who are in control now, just screamed it down and said, we don't want it. Now they come in and they're pushing a situation for health reform that doesn't seem to really help as much as it should. And we're the only nation in the world who is developed that doesn't at least give some minimum health care to all of our people. Why is this? That it seems so ignorant and so short-sighted.
Well, we haven't even talked about the uninsured, which I think is what you're talking about.
I'm talking about anybody, ma'am. I'm saying everybody should have health care.
That's right.
Whether it's rich or poor.
Yeah. I mean, and in fact, there are 40 million, 41 million Americans who don't have any health insurance. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, providing health care, providing health coverage to people, whether it's drugs to people in the Medicare program or whether it's basic coverage, is expensive and it's divisive, and there's a lot of disagreement about how to do it. And the country's wrestled with this issue for a very long time, and I think it'll wrestle with it for a long time to come.
Well, then, if this administration has no qualms of giving ungodly sums to fight a war that's totally unpopular, why can't they protect their own citizens who have to pay for this war?
This is one of the debates that's going on in Congress right now.
Okay. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Well, in many ways, this, again, is a reflection of this ideological split mm-hmm. or vision of what America is or what the national government what the role of the national government is in America. That is, you have the Great Society and the sort of idea that the government should provide some basic social safety mechanisms, and then the idea that really people are best served by establishing fair ground rules and letting the market essentially provide solutions. Mm-hmm. Let free enterprise take over.
Yeah, and I think that Americans historically have been very kind of they have a very ambivalent attitude towards government, more so than in other countries, I think, than in some other countries. And I think that it's not surprising that we would end up with the kind of mixed system that we have, because it does reflect something in the American psyche.
I want to talk about some other issues, but just to sort of follow up on this particular Medicare reform or overhaul or revision, whatever we want to call it, I guess the question is, what would the prescription drug benefit do for people? Would it actually reduce people's out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs, especially given that costs are rising so quickly? I mean, do we understand how that would actually play out?
There is a benefit package that is been put together so far, and it would not cover as a rule what I think a lot of workers typically expect. It's not as big or generous a package, and the reason I think is just purely cost. The people who wrote the bills in both houses structured what they thought was the best they could do with the money available. It does have gaps in coverage, but I think the people I'm trying to remember now. It's roughly like a 50% copay for certain expenses, and then there's a gap in coverage, and then when you reach kind of a cap, there's a catastrophic protection. Mm-hmm. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
So that when you get really high drug costs, then it really kicks in. So.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens in Congress, in conference. We have another caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation, a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I thought that the people who are criticizing the Medicare prescription bill, its main criticism is that there is no cap on what the pharmacies, the pharmaceutical companies can charge. And that means that the pharmaceutical companies could charge anything they want and totally bankrupt the Medicare system. In fact, as I understand it, there is something in the Medicare prescription bill which says specifically that Medicare may not negotiate price with the pharmaceutical companies. And so this feels to me more like a giveaway to the pharmaceutical companies than a true Medicare reform bill. In fact, every time I hear the word reform, my price of everything goes up. So could you tell me who you are, ma'am? Are you speaking for, are you a policymaker? Are you part of the administration?
No. I'm sorry. Our guest is a reporter for the New York Times, so really her role is as someone who reports on these issues as opposed to making policy.
I see. Okay, thank you. So would somebody address that? Is it indeed the case that this bill would specifically prohibit Medicare from negotiating prices and presumably negotiating lower prices with the pharmaceutical companies?
You're right. One of the main criticisms of this bill is that it doesn't include any cost, real cost. What's the word I'm looking for?
Cost containment. It's
well,
that,
I mean, it doesn't. It doesn't allow the government to step in and set prices for Medicare population. Now,
except it does put caps on what Medicare will pay for people. People often will have higher copays than in other situations. And also, all Medicare people would have to participate, and some of us have pharmaceutical insurance that sounds a whole lot better to us than the blanket Medicare would be.
No, this is a voluntary program, ma'am.
Good.
You know, as the debate over prescription drug costs, prices is a very big debate that's going on, not just in Washington right now, obviously, but in states around the country. And as you know, I mean, one side says that it's just not fair that the prices are so high in this country compared to what they're charged in other countries.
Right.
And the other side says, the, you know, the side that, that defends the pharmaceutical industry basically says the reason that we have all these extraordinary drugs right now is because of research and development. And if you, you know, artificially hold the prices down low, then you will not get the R&D that will produce these wonder drugs.
Do you know how much of the research and development that the pharmaceutical companies spend, how much of that do they spend, and how much of that does the American taxpayer spend through grants to these companies?
That's part of the debate.
So do you know how much
I don't have the
federal
data in front of
government
me.
Spends on medicine research, both right there with the pharmaceuticals and through the universities, like the University of Illinois, which does a lot of federal research for the pharmaceutical companies?
Yeah, I don't have the data in front of me, but as you say, I mean, that's a big debate as well.
Sounds like another Focus 580 topic.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, I did want to ask, though, about the lobbying by the pharmaceutical companies. Obviously, they're very interested in this legislation, and they would be pretty vocal, I would guess, in representing their interests.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's the one thing about making health legislation is that there's always a lot of interest groups around.
Yeah.
And the pharmaceutical industry is definitely the 800-pound gorilla. So.
Mm-hmm. So Congress is going to listen. You know, and there are legitimate things to listen to, like you say, the you know, the development of new drugs, which, you know, we depend on for advancement of our medical care.
Right, right. I mean, there are, you know, there are two sides to this issue.
Yeah. Well, we have another caller.
Maybe more than two.
I promise I'll get right to this caller, but one more question on that issue. Here in Illinois, Governor Rob Blagojevich has essentially suggested that the state of Illinois buy prescription drugs from Canada.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. It
which is fascinating. I mean, the whole, you know, the whole debate over our prices compared to Canada's prices, I think, is one of the most kind of it's very hard for a lot of members of Congress to understand why that is the case. And, you know, in fact, a lot of people have been going across the border to buy drugs in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you looked into that? Why is there such a price discrepancy? Is that an issue that that you can talk about?
It's complicated, and I don't feel confident to lay it all out.
We'll take that up another time on the show. So we have a couple callers waiting. Let's go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Thank you. I'd like to follow up on the other woman's question. I understand why she asked if your guest was a politician. I just find it appalling that someone has to call in and ask a question that I assume the journalist as the expert should have mentioned in the beginning. And as I listen to this conversation, so many things have been finessed and we're not being really informed. I don't know whether your guest feels that we can't cope with information.
Well, I think there's a difference between information and interpretation, and I guess
I don't think that's an interpretation to point out that there's no that the pharmaceutical companies don't have a cap. That's information. We can interpret this any way we want to. The interpretation would be that it's a giveaway to people who've contributed to the politician's campaign. But to tell us that the pharmaceutical companies will not, that the government will not be able to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies is not interpretation. That's simply fact.
Right, and that's
and
what she said.
She should have talked about that in the beginning. And I would really hope that she will stop simply saying this is a question for debate and give us the sides of that. Okay? What are the two sides of the debate? Just give us the information. I'm not directing this towards your guest specifically, but I've heard so many journalists come on and be so uninformed about what they're supposed to be the specialists about. So I would really ask her to feel free to give us information. We can take it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment. You know, I think that, you know, it's difficult as a journalist necessarily to to give any, you want to be careful you don't spin any of the facts that you're giving, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you say to that caller in that case?
You know, there's a lot of things I could have said at the start.
Yeah,
I mean, that's one of them. So,
yeah.
You know, that's...
Yeah. Well, I mean, just the fact that you stated that, for example, one of the things that you just said is the pharmaceutical lobbyists are the 800-pound gorilla mm-hmm. in this debate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a statement of fact, and one can interpret that in a number of ways, and we hope the listeners are intelligent enough to make their own interpretations. That's one of the things that we try to give mm-hmm. people credit for on the show, is that they're intelligent enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your assumption when you're writing about this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, as a journalist for a newspaper, I try to present both sides of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the last two callers have very strong feelings about this. There are people maybe who are calling in now who have strong feelings on the other side of the issue. I try to, kind of capture the debate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. We'll go next to a listener in southeastern Illinois on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, a couple of things. One thing that I think is, I'll ask the first question, the other question first. In these discussions about prescription drugs and the high cost, I never hear anybody mention the programs that some of the drug companies have. Are those legitimate programs? I mean, does the media cover and publicize? Pfizer is running commercials saying that if I suppose for senior citizens, or maybe I don't know if there's a means test, or they don't go into detail, but they have some kind of a program that for a flat fee of $15 a month, they will provide a drug. Do you know anything about those, that type of program, or anything about Pfizer's program?
I know there's a variety of drug company programs out there, and obviously there's also, the states have certain programs that vary from state to state to provide some assistance for people who are really against it.
Well, I think this is the drug companies themselves
trying to
step in. Of course, the idea, I'm sure that their purpose is to avoid the government doing it, but I never hear any coverage about these programs. I mean, are they limited to just a very few drugs, or do you know any details at all about the Pfizer program, for example?
I don't.
Okay. One other thing that I think is should be taken care of, whatever else they do in the prescription drug department, and that is that, as I understand it from listening to this station, maybe NPR or maybe even Focus 580, there are many conditions which in the large cities where there are skilled surgeons available and hospital facilities are taken care of by surgery, heart conditions and that sort of thing. And these same conditions in rural areas, since they don't have the facilities available, they handle these situations with drugs. And the surgery, the Medicare covers the surgery in the cities, but people in the rural areas that don't have the surgical facilities and are using drugs, presumably are having to pay for their own drugs, so that you have two situations there where in one part of the country, the expense is being borne by Medicare, and in another part of the country, where they're using a different method to treat a condition, the individual is presumably having to pay for the drugs that meet the condition there. So I think that they certainly should make some kind of a change there.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting argument. There is a hope, I think, among people pushing for this legislation on the Hill that it will be, in many cases, covering these drugs will be cost effective over the long haul in terms of preventing unnecessary hospitalizations and surgeries and so on.
Mm-hmm. We're past our midpoint here with Robin Toner. She is senior writer in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. She covers national politics, including health care, from there. And we're talking about a variety of issues, in particular the Medicare reform effort underway in Congress. And we may get onto some other topics with regard to national politics. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a listener next on line number two in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I just have a comment and two questions. The comment is in reference to the first caller who was wondering why we don't have national health insurance. And I don't think there's any question that the reason why is because certain groups, the conservatives, basically want to squeeze themselves into the picture as middlemen, because a nonprofit benefit, health benefit, hurts their pocketbooks by limiting the size of their livelihood. I mean, it's so obvious. I mean, that's the only reason. You mentioned the possibility that you made a true statement by saying that people don't like, are ambivalent about government. But a lot of that is due to the disruptive and destructive role these same people take in Congress to destroy programs, to make them, you know, unworkable in the name of compromise. But anyway, I've got two questions. One is, what's new about, is there anything new in terms of fraud investigation in the Medicare program as it is now? And two, this one, kind of a personal one, do you know if the idea of letting retirees use their Medicare benefits in other countries where they might retire to has any legs at all? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the questions.
Yeah, I don't know about the second part of your question, frankly. And what was the first one?
Essentially...
what's going on with fraud?
Yeah, fraud in Medicare.
You know, I mean, is there something new going on? I mean, it's kind of an ongoing battle, I suppose, yeah. on the issue.
Okay. Fair enough. I have some other questions, but I'm going to defer to another caller waiting, line number one in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I was the lady who called earlier, and I was very pleased to hear that this is going to be a voluntary program. Mm-hmm. And my husband just pointed out to me that although it starts out being voluntary, our insurance companies, and we do have a pharmaceutical clause in our insurance, can decide, as they did with Medicare in general, well, if Medicare pays, then let's have Medicare pay first, and then maybe if there's anything left over, we will consider paying for it. And I believe the original Medicare, when they passed the bill, was that first the insurance companies would pay and Medicare would pick up the rest. But the insurance lobby was so huge and made so many contributions that instead of having insurance pick up first and then Medicare pick up the rest, mm-hmm. it became reversed.
Yeah.
I'd also like to make another point, which is in writing and in speaking, I wish people would stop talking about this as Medicare reform. It's not reform. It's a word that politicians use when they want. It's really a spin. It's not fact. It's spin. This is not reform. This has nothing to do with reform. And using the word reform just gives into their spins.
Okay. Well,
so
I
wish people would just stop using the word.
All right. Well, I've been using that word throughout this hour. Robin, what do you think?
We actually don't use the word reform, Medicare reform.
Yeah.
As a rule, because of just what the lady's talking about,
yeah.
There is a sense of that you're kind of putting a seal of approval, yeah, on something. And so,
okay.
Every once in a while, maybe a the word reform will slip into the paper, but by and large, we are encouraged to steer away from it.
Okay. Well, I'm guilty of spin here, but thanks for...
I mean, the problem is it's very hard to come up with like another word for it, overhaul or restructuring
one, yeah.
or kind of clumsy words, but...
Alteration, perhaps?
Right.
Doesn't have the ring to it. Well, speaking of spin, the 2004 presidential election is really kind of getting underway now, isn't it?
It really is, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you can really feel in Washington people's attention suddenly is what's going on in Iowa and New Hampshire and out in the trail.
Well, and tonight, it's tomorrow night,
the
Democratic candidates debate with Wesley Clark mm-hmm. for the first time, who mm-hmm. has joined. And I'm noticing at least one poll shows him now the front runner among the Democratic candidates.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely scrambled the race at the moment. Now, one thing when you've been involved in watch politics for a long time is you know that polls at this stage of the game can change and change and change a million times before the end. So it's too soon to say, but it's definitely interesting right now.
Yes, yes. Well, what I'm hearing a lot of is people kind of wondering what the Democratic candidates are going to do to distinguish themselves not only from each other but from the Republicans. I mean, there are a couple of cases where the candidates have clearly disapproved of President Bush's policies in Iraq and in a number of other areas, but I think a lot of people are still wondering what's the difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that the belief of a lot of Democratic elected officials and strategists is that if they can move, if the debate moves to domestic policy, mm-hmm. the economy, health care, Medicare, Social Security, that they have an important and compelling case to make against President Bush. I think they also feel a lot of the Democratic strategists will say that in order to get to that point, however, they have to have they have to meet the threshold of credibility on national security, and they have to be credible commanders in chief.
Presumably, Wesley Clark would possess those qualities.
I think that's one of the reasons why so many Democrats are attracted to Wesley Clark.
On the other hand, with regard to domestic policy, does he have credentials?
Well, I mean, we're waiting to hear, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
he
just he got in when? Well, like last Wednesday or Thursday,
right.
So. He certainly has a lot to flesh out.
Mm-hmm. On the other side, it seems that President Bush's approval ratings have fallen quite a bit in recent months. Since April, I believe, April at 71% and now somewhere around 50%.
Yeah. Part of that, I mean, it's interesting because Republican pollsters kind of put out the word last spring. We know that these numbers will come down. Mm-hmm. There is a phenomenon in American public opinion, which is, and it's totally understandable, which is, the American public rallies around a president in time of war.
Mm-hmm.
70 or 80%, I mean, President Bush's father had, I think, approval ratings at one point in the mid-80s, which is really extraordinary. I think there's a supposition, an assumption among a lot of strategists that, ratings at that point were kind of just reflected a general surge of patriotism and a general desire to kind of rally around our country at a time of war. Now I would think that there's a lot of concern among some Republicans. The White House people say that they're not concerned, that they feel quite confident. And in fact, they will say, and Democrats, I think, who've been through this will say the same thing, it's an incumbent president is hard to beat.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk about polls when it comes to elections, and here I am talking about polls. And I guess I'm wondering, do we pay too much attention, especially this early? Obviously, you can't really say who the front runner is among the Democrats. But, a lot of the criticism of press coverage of elections in the last few cycles has been the horse race sort of kind of reporting. And, is there any way to change that? I mean, does the New York Times, for example, when you're going into this election cycle, I'm sure you're talking about it at this point. How are we going to do this? What are we going to do? Who's going to do what? What's our plan here?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we are having those meetings about coverage. I think the answer is, obviously you do horse race. I mean, people want to know who's ahead, what's happening. But the issue is, what do you do beyond that? A paper like the New York Times tries to think about explaining who these candidates are, what their background is, how they're putting together their campaign, what makes them tick, and where they stand on the issues. And not only where they stand on the issues, but kind of how in the past, they, you know, their thinking has evolved on them. What they did as members of Congress or Senate or, you know, as governor. And I think altogether, I mean, you just want to explore as much as you possibly can about the candidates, their thinking, the debate, and finally where the country is right now. Kind of what, you know, what is happening with our economy? Where are people? You know, how do people feel about kind of the national security? So I think altogether, I mean, you want to do a snapshot of the country and the men and women who would run it at a particular point in time.
As the election cycle spins up, then you're going to be given a lot of spin, obviously. And I guess, how do you deal with that when someone is obviously trying to craft a message that, you know, that I don't want to say distort, but maybe spin is the best word. Do you report essentially what they say? Is there a way that you sort of as a reporter look at what they're saying and, you know, a few layers deeper than that and sort of give readers a chance to see beyond the spin?
I think you want to do both. I think you want, you know, it, again, at the times, we feel strongly about letting the candidate have their voice, you know, when they're presenting a proposal or when they're sketching out their vision. I mean, you know, give them a chance to say it. Give them a chance to say what they want to say. And then, you know, examine it. And examine it in the context of their own history, examine it in the context of, you know, what it would mean, what critics would say about it, what supporters would say about it. But, you know, the first step, I think, is to let them say what they want to say and then kind of move into the analysis and debate phase.
Now, this gets back to one of the points that was made by a previous caller who essentially said, why don't you just tell us, you know, information? And I think what the person was really wanting was some kind of greater insight into that information or, in fact, what I would call an interpretation of that information. When you report on things, do you sort of hope that people are, you know, they're looking deeper, they're actually reading between the lines so that they, you know, they take what they know and what you're giving them to come to some greater understanding? I mean, you can't tell people what to think.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and it's a fine line that you try to walk because, I mean, you don't want to be cryptic.
Right,
you know?
right.
And you know, but I think what she was looking for from me was an opinion. And I'm not in the opinion business. So.
Well, it's actually prohibited. You can't give your opinions.
That's right. So.
Right. Well, we have another call to talk with who may have an opinion.
Yeah.
We'll go to line number one in Champaign. Good morning.
Yeah, far be it for me to have an opinion.
No, you're allowed.
My opinion is that this horse race politics discussion, and I haven't heard all of it, so maybe I'm being hypercritical here, but it's what I hear all the time. And one of the things that rankles me is that they've assessed that the No Child Left Behind education reform that Bush got Kennedy to sign on to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the whole spiel, has inoculated the Republicans vis-a-vis the problems of education in this country. And when I listen to what's going on around this town, education is the biggest, hottest, you know, item. We have a consent decree to reform the racial inequities in the school system here. There's underfunding. There's not enough seats on the north side of town where the blacks live. There's not enough. I mean, so I don't hear anybody really on the Democrat side even actually making an issue of it. And it's actually to the credit of the New York Times, and it was one of their most 25 most emailed articles that Secretary of Education, and I'm forgetting his name right now, an African-American from Houston, you know, this is sort of the credential that Bush has on education in some way, that the Houston school system, it turned out they cooked the books. It wasn't as big as Exxon, but basically they went back and instead of calling it an excellent school system because of the results, outcome, et cetera, it actually rated poor. And I don't know if it was conspiratorial or everybody was just spinning it the way they wanted to at the lower levels, but that's what No Child Left Behind was based on in some ways, and it didn't work there, and it's not working here. And education is, you know, what I'm getting at is that it's been said by pundits and everybody that education is is, you know, he's been inoculated. He's done stuff. He's made a compromise with Kennedy. And then no, there's no real focus on how much ferment there is out here in Main Street America about the education problems. And I guess I'm just fulminating.
Okay, I think we take your point, though.
I know there's not a lot of time left, so...
That's all right. Well, let's get an answer from our guest.
Yeah, I understand your frustration, and I hear that a lot from people who too often feel like they listen to pundits or watch TV or read newspapers, and everything is, you know, issues like education or health care are basically viewed through the prism of, you know, who's ahead, who's behind, as opposed to like kind of the real complicated on the ground, real life issues that they are. And so, I mean, you're raising a point that I think is a valid one.
Well, do you think education is going to be a big issue in this election? Is it going to play out in a partisan sense?
You're asking me to do the same thing he just did. He said he didn't lie.
I can't help it.
I think that education will be one of those domestic policy issues that the Democrats will be eager to talk about.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, well, we just have a couple minutes left, and I guess I'm just curious, as a working reporter in Washington, someone who has covered politics for a long time, you've covered a number of election cycles. Are you looking forward to covering this one? Is it something that you really enjoy?
Yeah. I mean, I think presidential elections are just amazing times in a country, rare times, and I've covered every presidential election since '84, and I have to say, at the end of it, I know people think reporters are incredibly cynical, but I come away feeling kind of like a real patriot. But we have a great system that the framers knew what they were doing, and it's a great experience to cover. Yeah. It's a privilege.
Well, it's also changed a lot during that time, since 1984. I mean, I think I was thinking last night about how, you know, CNN was brand new back at the time of the Gulf War.
That's right.
And now we have MSNBC and Fox News and all the other cable news stations, and the news cycle has sped up so much.
The news cycle has sped up so much. Advertising, you know, that used to be so kind of central, you know, when everybody is spread all over the different cable networks and shows, and, you know, it's much harder to reach the audience now, and advertising, I think, plays a less of a role. It's changed the tech. And then, of course, you have Howard Dean and what he has shown about the power of the internet right now. So the technology has changed quite a bit.
But the New York Times, still the paper of record.
Technology's even changed the New York Times, but we're still the paper of record.
Okay. Well, we're here at the end of our time. I'm sorry there's a caller we can't take. We're out of time. Our guest has been Robin Toner. She is a senior writer in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. And I'm sure you've seen that newspaper on newsstands around here. Also, the New York Times is on the web, which is how I get to a lot of stuff there. And so, Robin Toner, thank you so much for being here.
It was fun.